I'm Michelle Martin of NPR News, and along with St. Louis Public Radio and Reverend Willis Johnson, we welcome you to Wellspring Church in Ferguson, Missouri. We are in Ferguson for a conversation. We want to know what people here are talking about in the aftermath of the death of a young African-American man named Michael Brown. The country and the world watched this town erupt in sometimes violent demonstrations in the wake of that death, which came, as we all now know, after a confrontation with a white police officer named Darren Wilson. Many things have happened since, these 3 weeks later. We hope this is a good moment to ask those who are willing to be here about their ideas, their thoughts, their feelings about what happened and what should happen now. I'd like to begin by thanking Reverend Willis Johnson for allowing us to have this conversation in the church which he leads. He's going to help us hear your voices over the next 2 hours. Let me be clear that we are recording this conversation for broadcast. It's likely to be slightly edited for space. I've been asked by St. Louis Public Radio to moderate this conversation, and in that role, my job is not to take sides and not to judge the situation, but to help us have a good conversation. And by good, I mean a conversation where we can hear each other. Sometimes that can be hard to do when feelings run high, but I know that we can do it, and I know you're all going to help me. And Reverend Johnson, you're going to help me first. And I'm going to start just by asking you to offer a brief word of welcome to our broadcast audience as well as to our audience in the church.
We welcome you to not only Ferguson, but specifically a house of worship known as Wellspring. It is a place where we reach out to people to connect them to others, to grow them in their understanding, to offer themselves in service. And so tonight we do so to you and to this community. We greet you in love and in peace.
All right. Thank you. Thank you all. And thank you all again for coming. This conversation, as I said, belongs to all of us, and over the course of the evening, we're going to be hearing from people who are here, present with us. We are also going to be hearing from people who are joining us via social media, via Twitter and Facebook, but we've also invited some leading voices in the community to help guide our conversation and also to hear from them about their thoughts about what's happened here. So joining us now are James Knowles. He is the mayor of Ferguson. Mr. Mayor, welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Rita Days is the Democratic Director of the St. Louis County Election Board. Many of you know her as a long-serving state lawmaker. Senator Days, I know that you're no longer serving in that role, but Senator, giving you the respect of your office. Senator Days, welcome. Thank you so much for coming as well. Daniel Isom is set to become the new State Public Safety Director for Missouri beginning in September. He's a former St. Louis Police Chief. He's been serving most recently as a professor at the University of Missouri-St. Louis. Chief, Professor, Director, sir, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And Kimberly McKinney is CEO of Habitat for Humanity St. Louis. Kimberly, thank you, and of course, a longstanding person who's worked in the community in a lot of ways and has a lot of relationships that we think would be helpful to our conversation. Thank you for coming as well.
Thank you.
Now, each of you has comment cards on the chairs. You can write your name and where you're from. If you see your name on the screen, please proceed to the audience microphone. You can follow the conversation on Twitter using the hashtag BeyondFerguson. All right, I'm going to start by asking how you are. It's been a very emotional couple of weeks, a very difficult couple of weeks. So how are you, Mayor?
I'm well.
He's making a reference to his T-shirt for people who can't hear. It's the slogan of Wellspring Church.
Absolutely.
So,
remark.
You know, but are you really?
Absolutely. It's heartbreaking to see what's happened in our community, but I've also seen a lot of people come together, and so it's while this is a very difficult time for everyone in the community and difficult time for a lot of people across the nation, I'm happy to see our community start to come together, and I'm actually very happy to see a conversation started that should have been started long ago. And so I think, as I told many people when this started to erupt, that you know this incident here set aflame feelings that didn't start in Ferguson necessarily. But I think, and I think this is a testament to this, that we can hopefully end it here in Ferguson. So I'm glad we're having conversations. It was something that I mentioned early on at the first forum that we had at Christ the King Church, is that we will continue to have conversations because we haven't had enough conversations about some of these issues. So that is promising to me, and I do feel well about that.
We're going to talk about what you think the issues are, because I think many people might have different opinions about what those issues are, so I think we want to hear more about that.
Well, I'm also here to listen.
Of course.
Because clearly I want to know what people feel the issues are.
So. Okay. What about you, Senator? And I know you're the mother of at least one son, correct?
Yes, one son.
And I know that these events, like a lot of mothers of sons and daughters, but particularly sons, have been very difficult. Do you mind sharing what some of those thoughts are that you have through this?
Well, I'm troubled because I am old enough to have witnessed some of the things that happened during the civil rights movement, and it was disturbing that many of those things seemed to be repeating themselves. As you said, yes, I have one son and who's 39, and so he has grown up in the St. Louis area, and I also have two daughters. But coming from the South, as I was raised, these things were very vivid to me, and so it looked to me as if we were regressing instead of going forward. And so that's disturbing because I have grandsons, and I don't want them to have to go through what, you know, I've gone through as a child and what, you know, the Brown family is going through. Now my heart goes out to them because I cannot imagine burying my son. And so it's very tragic, and, you know, I just offer them the sympathy and prayers and condolences of, you know, of everyone. It's just unbearable that you would have to go through something like this. But it's real. But I do want to say that I'm very pleased that this is a conversation. I do not think this town has had a conversation about race. I think we have buried a lot of the issues, a lot of the feelings that are bound, and it makes it very, very difficult to move through life when you're harboring concerns and issues and they're not able to be brought forward. So I'm very pleased for the conversation, so I look forward to hearing what particularly the audience has to say. Mm-hmm.
Chief, what about you? What does this bring up for you? I mean, you have such an interesting background, both as a person who's been in law enforcement for a long time, as a person who studies a lot of issues related to law enforcement, and as a human being who walks around the street yourself every day. And just tell me briefly, what does this bring up for you?
Well, for me, I think it brings up frustration. Being a police officer for 24 years, I'm not surprised by the response of the public, because as a police officer, you work in areas that are challenged, that are impoverished, that have tension with the police, and you understand that there is a bubbling tension that goes on between the police and those communities. But also over a 24-year period, you know, I've seen so much loss. I've seen so much anger, hopelessness in neighborhoods. And so there's a sense of frustration that somehow we haven't been able to solve some of these problems.
You said you weren't surprised, though. That's surprising to me that you weren't surprised. A lot of people say they were surprised. Tell me, when you said that, what did you mean? You weren't surprised that people had as strong a reaction as they did to the death of this young man? What did you mean by that?
Well, I'm not surprised because, you know, for many people, they don't see the entire community. People only really see portions of the community that surrounds their life. As police officers, you see the entire community. And so you see communities in need. You see what they go through. You, in a sense, kind of understand why they might be angry, why they might be frustrated. And for police officers, you're generally on the ground floor. You're the face of government trying to hold it all together. And I think officers see it every day, depending on what neighborhoods you patrol. And they become frustrated because they seem to be the person on the front line trying to solve many of these social and economic problems.
Kimberly, what does this bring up for you?
For me, I feel conflicted. I think, you know, clearly there has been tragedy here that now, through the conversations, has presented an opportunity. And for Habitat for Humanity St. Louis, we're all about opportunity. For us, it's the opportunity to have home ownership, which, you know, entwined in the poverty issues and what has, you know, become race issues, is that we also have to make sure we're meeting basic needs, whether it's housing, whether it's employment, whether it's job training, you know, working with the police. The betterment of our communities isn't reliant on any one of those things. It's intertwined in all of those things. And working with the population that we do and knowing the challenges they face and knowing that all of our homeowners are not just first-time homeowners, they're first-generational homeowners most of the time, it really is, it's time for the change. Back to the comments that Senator Days made, it's time for our grandchildren, their grandchildren, to not have to experience this again.
You're already feeling very, tell me what you're feeling right now. You seem like you're about ready to cry. And I hope you don't mind my noticing that, but that seems true. What are you feeling right now? What's bringing that up for you?
I feel very, very passionate about what I do with Habitat. I'm also very embarrassed right now. I feel very passionate about what I do. I feel privileged to represent people who wouldn't have an opportunity. And I think we all need to take that really serious. The opportunity this has presented, I think the conversations we are having are great, but I'm going to equate it. I mean, we build houses, so I'm going to keep coming back to that. You know, the conversations are great, and we need to have them for as long as people feel like they have something to say and need to be listened to. But at some point, it's a little like doing community planning. We can plan a community to death. If we don't actually turn dirt, if we don't build something, then nothing changed. So I think I take that serious, and that's what fuels the passion. And I think you know, out of this tragedy, it's time for all of us to take that serious. Mm.
Reverend Johnson, you're in the truth-telling business, and tell us some truth that needs to be told right now.
Personally, and I think many in this community, in this room, their feelings, their emotions, their perspective have run across the spectrum. They've ebbed and flowed, and I know I've gone from feeling hurt to wanting to hurt, feeling helpless, even while I've been trying to help. And yet somehow in all of this, I think we all want to be and we need to be continually hopeful, but honest about the fact that we may not and don't really know how to do it by ourselves. Mm-hmm. But somehow this effort, this exercise, this human work for a human cause requires us to do something, and it requires us to do something together that we build, that we can build on, whether that's the hope or whether that's the healing of the frustration or it's the assuring of the legacy and the heredity of what is right and what's promised.
Reverend Johnson, why did this happen? And now let me just be clear that I was not there that day. As far as I know, none of the people up here was there that day. And this is a matter for law enforcement and other authorities to continue to investigate. So we're not here to litigate the facts of that particular case, but about why people reacted as they did. Why did this happen?
I believe that we have gotten to this place because at some point in the course of the afternoon of August 9th, action was taken that was perceived on to be necessary. And I think a lot of people are challenged to accept that, however you see it, that a death sentence is necessary for anyone or for anything. That's hard to accept. And I think it's hard for any of us to honestly accept that, that someone, another human being, has been lost. But more importantly, it then just, I think, unleashed all of the anger, all of the pain that comes with being lost or being feeling as if, more importantly, that you're not worthy, that you're devalued. And when we don't value life, however you see that for whatever reason, that is of critical concern for all of us. And I think you saw a reflection of that and have seen a reflection of that, a response to that.
Mr. Mayor, why did this happen?
I mean, I think as the pastor said, I mean, there's clearly frustrations, not just in this community, but across the St. Louis region, across the country. There's people who feel disconnected, people who feel disconnected from law enforcement, people who feel disconnected from the other parts of the community. And, you know, I think that when you saw, you know, this horrible tragedy take place, and so much of it, you know, was right out there on social media. It was very visible to see him in the street. I mean, it was shocking to anybody who saw it, to see myself, who wasn't there, but you felt like you were there because you could see all the images. I think that just tore the scab off of, you know, a wound that's, you know, been there across the country. And I think that's why we saw people come from all around the country to speak out, during these protests.
You know, you use the word disconnected, but I don't live here. But I've been here all day talking to people, and the word that I keep hearing over and over again is disrespected. Disrespected, demeaned, harassed. And in the spirit of full disclosure, I'll just tell you, within 5 minutes of our arriving in town, we saw a police officer pull over a middle-aged lady. And in the course of coming back to the hotel, we saw another police officer in the middle of a kids coming out of school, getting into an altercation. The first was Ferguson,
okay,
and the second was a nearby town.
Okay.
Used language that to talk to kids to break up a kid fight, mm-hmm, that I don't think a lot of us would have appreciated hearing. They used the F word with these kids. So the word I keep hearing is demeaned, harassed, and disrespected. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think what you said, though, is a perfect example about how this isn't just a Ferguson issue. And clearly, I'm not a law enforcement officer, but I think clearly we need to talk about how the law enforcement interacts with young people.
Okay, but the Ferguson police officers work for the city, so can we just talk about that?
Well, right, but I mean, the instances you gave were about law enforcement in general. So it's absolutely not acceptable for any police officer, especially any that may be under the command of our city, to be disrespectful, to not show respect to anyone of any age. And if anything like that happens, of course, and it's brought to my attention, I'll absolutely deal with it. But I think there's absolutely, as you mentioned two different law enforcement agencies, and I think people who've come here from around the country will tell you that there's this divide between law enforcement and many young people. So there is a whole shift we need to look at about how we can better engage young people in law enforcement. We will be happy to lead that here in Ferguson, but I think it's something other communities need to join us with as well.
Let me ask you this. Fact check now, Jason. Were there solely young people involved in the protests? Jason was out there reporting.
Okay, it was a mixture of pretty much every age, race, you know.
And what did they say about why they were there?
Well, I mean, it really depends. A lot of people came to Ferguson from surrounding communities and told me what you basically just relayed, that they felt disrespected by law enforcement, that they had been harassed by law enforcement, that they felt that they were unfairly targeted by law enforcement. And many of the people that told me this were African-American people. And this has been an issue for years, not just in Ferguson, but in many other communities where, you know, it's predominantly black, but they have predominantly white police forces.
Can I ask a question about,
sure,
not just about, there are two issues here. One is the day-to-day street interactions.
Mm-hmm.
The other question I have for you as the mayor is a question of policy. One of the things that's come to light is that fines and fees are the second largest part of your budget. Second largest part of your budget. And is that the case? Is that a matter of policy that the municipal budget relies upon aggressive law enforcement to generate fines and fees? Is that the policy?
No, and actually, I was going to fact check you,
okay,
because there has been a lot of numbers being thrown around that has been stated about how much our budget has depends on law enforcement or fines and forfeitures. And in fact,
well, let me give you my source. My source is this was reported by a number of news outlets, by including NPR, that the Arch City Defenders, which is a group that tries to mediate some of these issues, reports that last year that the city collected $2.6 million in court fines and fees. It was the city's second biggest source of income of the $20 million it collected in revenues. So the whole question of tailgate police, aggressive law enforcement, some of it's philosophical. Some people feel if you address the small things, then the big things get taken care of. But some people think this is a matter of collecting revenue.
Well, for us, it's not a matter of collecting revenue. One thing that we've always focused on in Ferguson is to try and, as you mentioned, focus on trying to make sure that small things don't turn into larger things. However, as far as our fines and forfeitures go, we just actually passed our new budget. It came up in June about how much fines and forfeitures are. And it was actually raised at that meeting that we don't want to become one of the cities, and there are many cities in St. Louis, who are far worse as far as the percentage of their budget that depends on fines and forfeitures, some cities well over 50%, we made a statement at that meeting, we do not want to continue to increase the amount of money that comes from fines and forfeitures. Now, over the past few years, it has gone up, but that's primarily due to the fact that we started using red light cameras. And that was used simply as a force multiplier because we don't have officers who are able to sit at dangerous intersections and watch those intersections to keep people from running red lights, and it actually has helped in many cases with some of our traffic flow issues and some accident issues.
Are you aware that there is the level of resentment and anger about this that exists that we heard today with very little prompting? I'll give you an example. A woman named Ebony, who was interviewed by one of our reporters, Joe Shapiro, reporting for NPR, owes about $2,000 in fines and fees. She said she's been arrested before after she didn't pay off all of her fines, the last time just 2 weeks after she had given birth. Do you think that's fair?
I mean, I think it's very unfortunate. I would hope that she took the opportunity to contact our courts. We have on many occasions and continue to do amnesty programs where we allow people to come in, get a new court date. We'll wipe your failure to appear fines, which is what people are complaining about. They complain that they start with a small fine and they don't show up to court and they don't show up to court and they don't show up to court and they don't show up to court, and it balloons to a large fine. We work with people every year to say, come in, we'll give you a new court date, we'll be happy to wipe some of those fines away from you or some of those failure to appears. And so it's something that we continue to work with people on.
Chief, can I ask you about this? Can I ask you about this issue? Are you aware, have you been made aware that there is this level of resentment about fines and fees, is that people feel that it's not about law enforcement, it's really about money?
So a little discussion about sort of the history and eras of policing in America. In the 70s and 80s, it was considered to be sort of the professional era of policing, sort of just the facts. We go out and do our work, and a lot of police work was driven by numbers, how many arrests you had, how many tickets you had, and that's how people judge whether police departments were performing well. Into the 90s and post-Rodney King, there was this movement towards community policing, that police departments needed to be more engaged in the community, better partnerships, coming together and deciding how we're going to collectively keep our community safe. As we moved into 2000 and beyond, looking at New York, there started to be this movement in policing towards zero tolerance policing. If you deal with the very small things, arrest for everything that was minor, possibly you could avoid the big things.
What do you think is going on here? Do you mind if I ask that? Is it a matter of philosophy, this kind of zero tolerance, or what people call broken taillight policing, or is it money? And when you were chief, did people complain of St. Louis, not this town, but of St. Louis, did people complain about it to you?
Well, St. Louis, of course, is very different, and we spent more of our times on neighborhood issues than traffic. We had a dedicated traffic team. Clearly, our revenue was not very high in terms of traffic enforcement. But I will say that in light of zero-tolerance policing, hotspot policing, that we did put a lot of pressure on neighborhoods. We did a lot of enforcement, maybe not traffic tickets, but many arrests to try to control activity and problems within neighborhoods. Part of this is somewhat of a systemic problem, a greater problem. Now, I'm not saying whether or not they're using ticket revenue to support their budget or not. I haven't looked at the facts. But what I do know is that when you're poor, when you don't have a job, and you need means for transportation to get around places, sometimes you can't pay your property tax, your personal property tax. Sometimes you can't get your plates right. Sometimes you can't get your inspection right. And so as a result of that, people who are in those circumstances are going to be subject to tickets more than anyone else who has a job and who's able to pay their taxes, get their license plates, and all those things. Our system doesn't take that into account. You get a ticket, you keep getting a ticket, you keep getting a ticket. It goes bench warrant because you can't pay the fine.
That's not a law of nature. That's a policy decision to arrest people for not paying parking tickets. That's a matter of government. That's a decision. So tell me, and Reverend Wallace, I'm going to come to you next. And also, we've asked folks, Jeff Schultz has put a question forward, and A.J. Bell has put a question forward. So come on up, and while I'm going to ask, go ahead, finish that thought if you would.
So
and Reverend
I'll finish
Johnson,
the thought.
I'm going to ask you, too.
You're absolutely right. It is a policy decision. That people who don't have the means to pay their personal property tax, who don't have the means to, you know, pay for their license plate or even get a driver's license, that's a question for us. What do we want to do? Because the law says, this is what the law says, if you don't have those things, you get a ticket. And if you don't have those things, you go to court. And if you go to court and you can't pay the fine or you don't show up to court, it goes bench warrant. And this is the frustration of officers. We know that. We know a person who has multiple bench warrants, and we arrest them over and over again. And we ask, is there any way that the system recognizes that this person does not have the means to pay? That's a question for all of us to ask ourselves as citizens.
Well, we're waiting for Jeff. Are you there? And we're waiting for A.J. Bell. Where are you? Where's A.J.? A.J., are you there? Okay, great. Reverend Johnson, I'm going to ask you about this question. We've raised two issues here, which is we've talked about fines and fees. We've talked about the economic pressure on people. We've also talked about attitude, people using language that none of us up here would appreciate being spoken to. What do you hear from the people who talk to you? What's their main beef? Is it the attitude? Or is it the issue itself? Is it the fines, the fees, the feeling like they're being shaken down?
Yeah.
Or is it the attitudes when people speak to you, they're not spoken to with an attitude of respect?
It's all of it, which could basically be summed up as insensitivity, both from the individuals and the system. It is, again, a concern of that we see people either as numbers or as issues, or we operate specifically by the letter of the law and not by the spirit of the law, which I know is hard to try to balance when you are on the front line as a traffic officer or even as a legislator trying to balance the needs and the responsibilities both to your community and to honoring what has been handed down through your various systems. But I think what you hear ultimately is insensitivity. And until we have some sensitivity training, and until we have some sensitivity legislating and community development that is affectionately as well as intimately wanting to deal with this thing, you're going to keep hearing that, because all of that is about respect.
Just briefly, can I ask the folks in the audience, have you ever, no matter who you are, ever felt that you've been treated inappropriately by the police? I'm particularly interested. Many hands go up. I see people of a lot of different backgrounds with their hands up, both people of color, people who are of European history, let's say. I see many hands. Are there people here who generally believe that police are doing an appropriate and a good job in this community, who generally believe they're doing a good job? You generally believe they're doing a good job? Yes? Okay. Good. You do? You do? Can I see the hands of people who believe the police generally do a good job? Okay. Can I see the hands of people who believe the police are generally respectful in their interactions with the public? Can I see the hands of people who believe the police in this area? I'm asking this area, because if you're from Miami, this is not what we're talking about today. Or, you know, another day. Do you believe the police are generally disrespectful in their communications with the public? I see lots of different hands go up. So, Mayor, that's something for you to consider. That feedback is for you to consider, I would think, how you interpret that information, because I can't. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Ferguson and Beyond, a community conversation. This is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Michelle Martin, and we are at the Wellspring Church with Reverend Willis Johnson and a distinguished panel of thought leaders from the area, including the mayor of Ferguson, James Knowles. You are also joining our conversation. You can follow us on Twitter using the hashtag #BeyondFerguson. Jeff, tell us what you have to say.
I appreciated everyone's comments up here, especially related to what this event was about in the larger sense of a lot of the frustration that I think people legitimately experience in terms of how policing happens and interactions with law enforcement officials, though they may be doing a good job in general. And a lot of that disrespect, the harassment, is invisible to white people like me. And that's a big problem. There was a story going around on social media recently that for white people, 91% of people in social circles are other white people. Now, maybe that's not true here in North County, but I have a 17-year-old son who's almost 18 as well, so this story hits me at an emotional level, too. His friend was over the other night talking about riding his bicycle home one evening, getting stopped by a policeman and being harassed about, where'd you get that bike? What are you doing in this neighborhood? Can you prove that this bike is yours? How many 16-year-olds are going to have a receipt for a bike?
Now, was this kid white or black?
A black kid. That's not going to happen to my son because he's a white kid.
Are you finished with that thought? Go ahead.
I was just, it's a real and a big problem that I think was highlighted and expressed through the protests and you know, what we saw here happening over the last few weeks. One of the things the question that I was trying to get to is, a lot of times we hear about white privilege, and I understand that. And we're talking about discrimination, we're talking about injustice, we're talking about different ways of treating people based on where they live or the color of their skin. My question is there a maybe more helpful way to talk about that injustice? Because my concern is the language of privilege puts white people on the defensive. It makes white people feel like we're being accused of getting away with something when I think we're talking about human rights and human dignity that's not a limited resource. So my making sure that other people are treated fairly and treated with dignity does not take anything away from me. And it's something that we should all be engaged in working towards. So my concern is that, honestly, you know, if white people are the ones who typically in our culture are in positions of power to affect policy and to make changes to along these lines, how can we do a better job of talking about the reality of injustice, discrimination, and disrespect in a way that will engage majority whites for whom that is largely invisible?
I'm going to hope that a lot of our second hour is going to be devoted a lot to where we go next. So hopefully I'm going to bring that up next, if that's okay. Okay, thank you for your comment. AJ, come on up.
Good evening. So we're talking a lot about traffic tickets and things that may or may not have a direct impact on what happened over the last couple of weeks. And one thing I noticed, I've been to about half a dozen events and rallies related to what's going on in Ferguson, specifically concerned about the community of Ferguson. And what I've noticed is that there is an overwhelming number of young people out there, and they are passionate about this situation and what's going on and what is going to happen, and having a voice in a way I've never seen young people have that voice. And I'm curious as to why there are no young people on the panel. I see young people in the room. I see young people in the room who I know, because I've heard them speak at other events, who were out there at night. We're out there in Ferguson. They've been tear gassed and they've been, you know, running from the police. These are not thugs. These are not criminals. These are college students and youth pastors. And I want to know if we can give them the opportunity to directly tell the mayor, you know, their experience and give him the opportunity to kind of respond to why they were treated that way when they were peacefully protesting for multiple nights in a row.
Did you bring anybody with you who
no,
would like
I
to be heard?
This young lady right here.
Does she wish to be heard?
Yes, she will.
Come on up. Do you mind telling us who you are?
I'm Alexis Stumbleton. I'm 20 years old. I go to UMSL, and I live in Lake Pembroke, which is about 2 minutes from here. I don't know how many people are from Ferguson.
So. Tell us what your experience is.
My experience is pretty different because I live on the white side of Ferguson, which is by Lake Pembroke and Jane Ray Wabash and things. But I was also down on West Florissant, so I got to see the black side of things, and I do air quotations. It's different to see how many people in my neighborhood who don't know about what's going on. They have no idea at all. And it's astounding.
Well, what's going on? Take this opportunity to tell what's most important for the mayor to know right now.
For the mayor to know right now is that the people that are up under you are directly taking our rights away. I can't explain to you that my First Amendment rights have been taken away, and that I have been told directly by a police officer that I don't have this right when I know for a fact I do. I was told that I did not have the right to assemble, and I know for a fact, you know for a fact, we all know for a fact that we have the right to assemble. The people working directly up under you told me that the Missouri Constitution, the state in which we live, where they are enforcing laws, told me and Devin, my friend, that in the Missouri Constitution, we are not given the right to assemble like in the federal Constitution. this is on video. This is what I was told. Okay. And I mean, it just gets as simple as that. And we can go further, you know, as to say we're being treated like animals, but that's the start. We don't have any rights right now. And that's what we're out here fighting for, things that we were given from the day we came out of the womb in America. And
do you want to?
You just mentioned that you have this on video,
and I
want to make this vow to you right now. Please get me that video, and if he is an officer up under me, I vow to you that he will be disciplined.
Okay.
Okay?
All right, then.
Come on up. Yeah. Sir, come on up. Tell us your name, do you mind?
I'm Jay Mitchell, CEO and owner of Jarts Entertainment, which has the purpose to illustrate and demonstrate the necessary needs of education through the performing arts to elementary, middle school, and high school children. Basically, this is to the whole panel because I had the same question about the purpose and why there was no one of a younger age on the panel.
Well, you know what? You're here now, so take advantage of the opportunity to be heard now. I mean, you know what I mean? Who's on the panel? Is that really as important as what's been said? What's said? So speak your truth.
Well, that's a portion of the truth, because I say that only because there was an email that was sent out by someone who said that they did not hear back from the youth, and that's why I'm bringing it up.
Okay.
I'm making mention because of the fact that, you know, they said, well, is there a voice with enough power who can speak on behalf of the youth? I'm sorry. We've been out there. We've been marching. We've been hollering. That's why I have no voice now.
But that's what's most important to say. You got all these people up here who have important responsibilities and who are listening to you. What's the most important thing you think they should know?
To take us seriously. That if you hear nothing else from me tonight, to take us seriously. I mean, in all necessary means of what I'm saying, you know, we've been hurt, and I look past this beyond just a racial issue or police brutality, because we also need to police ourselves, take responsibility for ourselves, but also in that action with the police brutality that has been going forward, to pay that attention, not just let it be an underlying issue, you know, that goes beyond the means of being swept under the carpet again. So that I mean, okay, if nothing else is said, to take us seriously and know that we are trying, and that this is a pivotal point that St. Louis is going to make a change that not only St. Louis will see, but that the world will see.
Thank you for that. You know, Thank you. The irony is, Mayor, you're one of the youngest mayors in the state. You were first elected as one of the youngest mayors in the state. Is it kind of surprising to you that so many of the young people in this community,
now I'm old,
well, feel that they are not heard at all?
Well, I have to say I understand that feeling. I was elected. You know, I started running for office. I was 24 years old, and nobody on a council full of 55 to 70, you know, between 55 and the oldest was 70 years old, cared what the 25-year-old city councilman said. That was until I became the senior member of the council, and then the mayor. I've struggled with that too. And I understand, I can't understand completely. I was young once. I'm not going to say that I completely understand. That's why I'm here listening to trying to understand. But, you know, a lot of people don't understand that I coach wrestling down the street, McClure South Berkeley High School. Every fall, you know, 30 to 40 African American men spend all winter with them. I hear the frustrations from them too. We have meaningful conversations with that small group.
When they tell you that they feel that they are being literally hunted on the streets, what do you say to them? Have they ever said that to you, that they feel that they are literally being hunted on the
street,
that they have
no rights?
It's never
been put to me like that by any of them. I will say this. I always tell them this, first and foremost, if you ever have that interaction with a Ferguson officer, I can take care of that. And if you ever have that with any other officer, I think it's important that we take that to their department or to their city council as well, because that's absolutely unacceptable.
Nobody has ever told you directly a feeling that they were.
No one's ever said the words, they've been hunted on the streets in my wrestling room. So,
okay.
But I hear that from people out there, and that's important that we hear those kind of conversations, absolutely. Because it's important that we understand that there is that feeling out there so that we can do something about that.
This is. Well, hold on a second, because I can't even really hear what you're saying. So, you're saying they're hiding behind the badges?
I think what they're saying is,
somebody,
I could hear them. What was said was that there's officers who are hiding their name tags, and I know this because and their badges or their badge numbers aren't even assigned to them in Ferguson. So that's not. I think the concern that I've heard, not just in this room, but for the past couple of weeks, is that many officers have taken their name badges off, And I don't know that, but I do know that, and
hold
it may
on,
be.
Hold on. If we can't hear each other, we can't speak together.
Right.
So I can't.
Absolutely, it would be concerning. It's concerning to me that if anybody would have an interaction with an officer that they weren't able to then point out, that's absolutely concerning to me because.
Is that the first time you've heard this?
First time I've ever heard it was this incident. With the protesters and then the subsequent looting and riots, that has been brought up to me. That's never been brought up to me before. I personally, until this started, have never seen our officers not have their name tag on.
But let me ask,
I understand the concern there because clearly if they're anonymous, and I can personally tell you what it feels like for people to anonymously threaten and everything else for the past 3 weeks, I've been getting it from all over the country. I can see the concern that an officer who can't be held accountable because they don't have a name tag on would be concerning to an individual they encounter, and that's concerning to me too. So clearly that's something we need to address.
Senator Diz, let me ask you this. Nationally, we've been hearing about this disconnect between the city leadership, not just law enforcement, but the city leadership overall and the population that lives here. It's been noted by many people that the population of the city is far more diverse than the people who are in elected leadership, that there is that the police force is overwhelmingly white, that there's only one person of color on the council, and yet we also hear that the voter turnout is extremely low in municipal elections, and I'd like to ask you about that. What's that about?
It is extremely low, and it's appalling that we have people who consider only the presidential election as important. We have people that tell us all the time, I only vote in the presidential. But when it comes to your mayor, your city council people, your governor, we just don't do it. Now, I will tell you that in the April election, there was about 1,500 people that voted in the city of Ferguson. The population is over 21,000 in the city of Ferguson. So you look at the mayor was the only person he ran unopposed in that election. And so it's just an abysmal turnout when you look at this. And you have no other voice. And people think it's a cliche. This is the only place that you are equal to every other person in this country. And if you don't exercise the right to vote, then do not complain. Even young people, and there are major voter registration drives going on right now.
Okay, but tell me, why is it that people aren't voting? If they have this level of concern, why aren't they voting? And why is, all respect to you, Mr. Mayor, running unopposed? If there's this level of dissatisfaction with the leadership of this community, why is he running unopposed? Why is the prosecutor running opposed, which I understand many people have take issue with? They don't believe that he has the necessary dispassion. He was opposed?
In the primary.
Fall.
Yes.
Okay, so tell me why.
Well, people look at those positions. Some people feel that I don't have the money. It takes money to run for office. It takes a collective compassion you know, to actually run for office and put yourself out there. And I'm not sure a lot of people are willing to do that. Right now in the state of Missouri, we have term limits, so we have to turn over every every 2 years, the House runs, and every 4 years of the Senate. But you have a maximum of 8 years that you can serve. And so hopefully, you know, that will bring other people in, we think. But if you don't put yourself out there to run for these offices, then these are the consequences that you have. People who have war chest, a lot of money. And so how do you go against them as a neophyte in this process?
I hear what you're saying. We have a lot of questions from the audience now. They're starting to come in, and we appreciate that. And a lot of them are about the police and the interactions with law enforcement. So, but there are a couple of factual issues that came up, and I did want to ask if Jason or Rachel has anything to say about that, this whole question of police officers particularly just not revealing their names or something. Do you have any insight on that that you can share?
I have a more specific question to the mayor, because you've said multiple times that if there's problems that you personally would take care of it. But I've read your charter and I've read your ordinances, and it is a direct violation of your charter to order any employee to do anything. So I'm just curious how you're actually going to follow through on it when your office doesn't really allow you to directly do anything with the police.
I wish you would tell that to Arch City defenders who, quote, misquote statutes and think I have more power than I have, because I don't. But I do have this. The city manager works for the city, or works for the city council, works for myself and the city council. And the dynamic of a city manager council form of government is that the city manager answers to us. Concerns that we have as council members, as the mayor, are brought to the city manager and dealt with. And of course, if they're not dealt with in a fashion in which we believe is acceptable, then, you know, we take that action with the city manager. I have a great relationship with the city manager. He is very committed to having a professional police department as well. I know that any concern such as that I would bring to the city manager, he would follow through with, and would continue to do so until the day he doesn't, and then he'd have to find a new job. So,
Emily Davis, can we hear from you?
Good evening, and I apologize. I had to write this down because it is a very emotional issue for me as both a mother and a human being. I live in Ferguson. I love a lot of things about Ferguson. I am the mother of three young children, and as Mr. Johnson mentioned, I have been through a lot of emotions. The first was deep sorrow, but now I'm angry. And I'm angry about what the police have done to my community and our residents here. I'm angry at the people in power who let the police terrorize and abuse our citizens, who have demeaned, harassed, and disrespected our citizens. And certainly, no one has felt either protected or served during this. And I need to hear some immediate solutions for improving community and police relations. When I walk down Florissant, my children and I have been out every day volunteering or protesting. And when I walk down West Florissant, I see the police in groups in their cars. I see them standing there waiting for something to happen. I see Captain Johnson out there shaking hands during the marches, but I still don't see any engagement. They're just standing there. And my kids are confused. My son said, I thought police were the good guys. And my feeling is that no mother should have to fear for her son's life every time he leaves home. And it breaks my heart that mothers anywhere, especially here in my community, have to feel this way every day. Not just Michael Brown's mother, but the mother of all those protesters out there just trying to make this better. And so, like I said, I need to hear some immediate solutions of getting the police involved and engaged on a level of respect for the community, because that is certainly not what we've seen.
Mark DeSantis, can you please tell us what's on your mind?
Sure. I'm a Ferguson resident. I've been living here for 2 years. And, you know, regardless of what your race is, your political background, I think everybody would agree that every police officer should have a camera, should have a vest camera, should have a dashboard camera. And what I'm asking, specific to the Ferguson Police Department, what date can I expect every police officer to be equipped with a camera?
Okay. Do you want to briefly respond before we take a short?
We just
we're not take a break. It's not really a break. We're just going to sort of lead into our second hour. Do you want to briefly respond, Mr. Mayor?
We just got 35 of them. Some of them are already in service. They are currently being trained on them. They shall be in service, you know, expeditiously. I mean, they'll be right out. So. I don't have the date.
Police officers in this city will now be equipped with body cams. Is that correct?
The ones that are on duty. Like I said, we have 35 that we've gotten in. I believe there's 54, 53 officers, sworn officers. So they're not all out at the same time. So at this point, going forward, we're going to be having officers on patrol, people on the streets, people having interactions with the community. We'll have vest cams on, correct.
Okay. Reverend Johnson. We're concluding our first hour of conversation here. Just give us a brief thought, if you would, about is there anything you've heard here that you particularly want to highlight? Is there anything you really want to elevate that we haven't really focused on that you really want to think it's really important to pay attention to?
Well, I think, respectfully, our mayor has invited us to hold him and those that represent us in this community to task. And if there are things that they can address and there are situations that he wants to help us to resolve in a healthy way, in a positive way to move our community, then he's given us the charge and the invitation to do that. And I think that's what we need to do.
If you're just joining us, you are listening to Ferguson and Beyond, a community conversation. I'm Michelle Martin from NPR News. I'm here with St. Louis Public Radio, which is convening this event at the Wellspring Church with Reverend Willis Johnson and a distinguished panel of guests. Kimberly McKinney, she's the CEO of Habitat for Humanity St. Louis. Daniel Isom II has now been named the Director of Public Safety for the state of Missouri. He's a former police chief from St. Louis. And Rita Days, former state senator, is a leading political figure here. We're all here at Wellspring Church. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have more from Ferguson. You can join this conversation on Twitter using the hashtag #BeyondFerguson, and we hope you will hang in there with us.